From KCRW and KCRW.com, I'm Evan Kleiman, and this is Good Food. Today, it's the Chef Show. And joining me to navigate Who's Who in LA's kitchens is Leslie Barger-Suter of Los Angeles Magazine. Welcome, Leslie.
Hello.
New York chef April Bloomfield defines the gastropub.
Joseph Centeno dishes on his next restaurant concept, Tex-Mex.
Michael Ruhlman weighs in on the making of a chef. But first, as always, let's check in with Laura Avery to find out what's fresh and in season this week at the Santa Monica Farmers Market.
This is Laura Avery with the Market Report. We're happy to welcome a new chef to the market who is very enthusiastic about his new restaurant and what he's doing and, of course, what he's finding at the market. His name is Phil Castell, and he's the chef at a gastropub restaurant that's located downtown. It's called Public School 612. And Phil, tell us what you're looking at here today and what kind of food you're cooking down there at Public School.
You know, with the fall coming in right now, we're looking at different ingredients. So right now I'm looking at the dried chilies, I'm looking at squash and things like that. One recipe that we're getting ready to do on the Public School 310 restaurant is we are going to do a stuffed quinoa poblano pepper. And it's going to have a lot of roasted vegetables in it, roasted corn, roasted butternut squash. It'll have beets. It'll have chilies. It just goes on. So everything that I'm finding is going to be in this. And then what we're going to do is we're going to also take a dried chilies that we're finding, and we're going to roast them and smoke them, and we're going to make a sauce out of it. And so it's going to be kind of a vegetarian option, but with tons of flavor. And the quinoa, obviously, you know, very hot right now, and will add a lot of protein to that dish.
So, you know, a lot of people would like to do that at home. And is there a certain trick to how you professionals do it?
You know, I mean, with roasting the poblano, it is a little bit difficult. I mean, you definitely have to char it on all sides, kind of steam it, you know, under a little bit of plastic so the skin will remove. But it's just, it's delicate, and it takes a lot of time and a lot of patience. You know, if you're someone that doesn't have patience in the kitchen, don't peel a poblano pepper, you know. But honestly, I mean, it's steaming the skin until it releases naturally, cutting a little bit open, and then just... It's very careful. It's tedious, but it's a wonder. You get a wonderful reward, you know, to be able to stuff that pepper.
Oh, that sounds so good. And, of course, we've got a lot of poblanos right now. And we have the beautiful, the Anaheims. We have all chilies coming in. Would that work as well with one of the sweeter peppers, like the big bells?
With the big bells, oh, sure it would. Absolutely. If somebody doesn't want a poblano chili, or if you want to do this when the poblanos really aren't as, you know, plump and beautiful right now, sure, you can do it with the bell pepper as well.
So exciting. That just sounds tasty. Thank you so much for creating that for us.
Thank you.
That was Phil Castell. He is the executive chef at Public School number 612. Soon they will be opening another Public School 310 in Culver City, and obviously excited about being at the market and sharing wonderful recipes. Barbara Wyman, who is a longtime employee over here at Tutti Frutti Farm, is one of the premier experts on all things that Chris Cadwell grows. And one of them is a wide variety of peppers, just like the one Chef Phil was just talking about. And Barbara, so today it's mid-September. Your table's loaded with beautiful peppers. We're actually roasting some out of the Pico Farmers Market right now on Saturdays. Most people want the Hatch pepper or the Anaheim. Tell us what kind of peppers you have, and can you briefly describe what they taste like?
Well, I'll categorize them first in the sweet, that we have the red bell peppers, the orange bell peppers, and the tequila, which is like a combination purple, orange, yellow. They start out purple instead of green, like the red and the orange bells, and then they turn to this multicolor. And the other one we have is a lipstick. I don't have them today because I sold them all, but those are the really pointy red ones.
And really sweet.
Yeah, they're the sweetest of all the peppers. And then we have the medium, like spicy, which is the Anaheim, the poblano, those are the two that, you know, they're bigger. People use them in chili relleno for stuffing. They just have a little bit of spice. And then we have a hot group, which we start with the jalapeno, you know, the one that everybody knows, a good hot pepper. The serrano, which is a smaller and a little hotter. And then we have the Santa Fe, which is a yellow, looks just like a jalapeno, but yellow. And it's about the same heat area. And then we have the habaneros, the top of the line as far as the heat goes. And that pretty, at this time, pretty much covers everything that we've got on the peppers.
Right. And the other thing that's great about you is you're certified organic, and bell peppers and peppers in general are always those things that are in the top 10 of the Dirty Dozen list. These are the things that get the most pesticides ever. Tutti Frutti is completely 100% certified organic, always have been, and so you are probably the best place to get peppers. So thanks so much, Barbara. And the display is gorgeous. How long will you have the peppers?
Oh, we should have them at least a couple more months.
Fabulous. Okay. Thanks, Barbara.
You're welcome. Thank you.
That was Barbara Wyman, and she really is the grease that turns the wheel here at Tutti Frutti Farm. And they have a beautiful display at every market they go to. It's certainly worth checking out. Everything's certified organic. For the Market Report, this is Laura Avery.
Chef Phil Castell's recipe for stuffed poblano chili is on the Good Food blog. I'll be joined by Leslie Barger-Suter of Los Angeles Magazine in just a minute. But first, time for a visit from Jonathan Gold. He's the Pulitzer Prize-winning food writer for the LA Times, and we love when he comes by each week with a restaurant recommendation. Today, we're checking out The Parish, a pig-centric gastropub in downtown LA.
Many restaurants are pig-centric in L.A., and this may be one of the more pig-centric of them. Most big-ticket restaurants, you find a big steak on the menu. At Parish, you have big pork chops. There's a pork porterhouse at 32 ounces, and I think there's something like a 46-ounce pork chop.
Oh, my goodness.
That's a lot of damn pork. An entire table can eat pork.
Yeah.
And will.
Wow.
And it's a really nice pork chop. It's, you know, simply done. It's Berkshire, which is, you know, a pig with a nice amount of marbling on it. And there it is, your pork chop.
So if you're more of a grazer, you like to have a little bit of more variety, is this a restaurant that's offering some small plates?
Yeah, of course there are. There's all the gastropub essentials. There's, you know, deviled eggs, and there's chicken liver mousse with onion rings. And something that's from the chef's first restaurant, Tasting Kitchen in Venice, that was always my favorite there and it's great here, which is just simply grilled brioche with a big lump of ricotta. And with ricotta, there's some peas. But it's the quality of the ricotta and the quality of the bread that comes through. At the Tasting Kitchen, there are probably more dishes that come with grilled bread or fettunta, which is olive oil rubbed grilled bread, than don't. Here, there's just a couple, but it's always something worthwhile. There's also a poutine menu here, which is not something you see many places.
Oh, I love that. So for people who don't yet know what poutine is, could you describe it?
Poutine is a Montreal dish or a Quebec dish of French fries with cheese curds and thick mushroom gravy.
And so there's a whole menu of it?
Well, there's a couple and it rotates. I've seen a few since I've been there. There's one with fried oysters that's nice.
Ooh, that's a nice idea.
And I think my favorite of the ones I've had was the one with pig's feet.
Okay, so you have to describe that.
The pig's feet aren't presented as giant feet. They're like – they're stewed, and they're sort of that slithery, gelatinous, you know, luscious pig's foot thing on the French fries with the gravy. And it's interesting that instead of cheese curd, he uses paneer, the fresh Indian cheese.
Which is basically like one big pressed cheese curd.
Exactly. And it doesn't have that sort of oozy meltingness of – cheese curds, but it does have the milky freshness that cheese curds also have, and I definitely approve of that substitution. The clams are something that are really nice. It's, again, sort of a gastropub staple, but they come in a broth with hot salami or hot sausages of various kinds and a little bit of sherry for sweetness and melted leeks and some peas. And the broth is thick and the clams are very fresh, and it's a really wonderful dish.
That sounds incredible.
They do have a meat pie there, a really big, proud standing meat pie. And the meat that they use in it is pig's head.
So you get all that richness and gelatinous quality that you would if you were to have head cheese, but instead it's just the shredded bits.
Right. I mean, if somebody didn't tell you that this was like made with testa or head cheese, you probably wouldn't know it. But there is that body to it, that presence is just wonderful. And one of the things that they're doing there is buying a whole pig every so often. And when you have a whole pig, you have to use all of it.
Yes, you do. I see they have fried chicken.
Fried chicken is probably what's going to get most people to the restaurant. It's really good fried chicken. It's tender. It's not the sort of crackling crisp fried chicken that you're used to. It's more of
homey style.
Exactly.
I love that.
There's grilled peaches on it because they're so good at this time of the year, which picks up smokiness and gives a little sweetness to the whole thing. And a little tomato salad. And that's it. It's a really simple, really nice summer dinner.
Thank you so much, Jonathan.
Thank you.
I've been talking to Jonathan Gold about The Parish on Spring Street in downtown L.A. Get a text message with the restaurant's address and Jonathan's recommended dishes by simply texting the words "good food" to the number 69866. That's "good food" to the number 69866. And don't forget that you can see all of Jonathan's restaurant suggestions on the Good Food restaurant map. It's pretty cool. Check it out on the Good Food blog. Coming up, I've got a killer lineup of chefs for you today on the show, plus a special visit from Los Angeles Magazine Dine editor Leslie Barger Suter. Stay tuned.
Make a donation of just a dollar a day and you can join one of our exciting and exclusive Angel Clubs. Choose from music, books, DVDs, or cookbooks delivered right to your front door. Learn more and join now at kcrw.com/join.
I'm Evan Kleinman, and you're listening to Good Food. We have a unique show planned for you today. Leslie Barger Suter of Los Angeles Magazine is sitting in the studio with me all morning for a special look at some of LA's best chefs.
Hello.
So, Leslie, you've never done a chef's issue before at Los Angeles Magazine. Why'd you decide to do one now?
You know, for years, we've been talking about the restaurants, and it seems like right now there really is a climate where we're really worshiping the chef. They don't have to be on television. We're really just liking the people behind LA's greatest food. And not only that, but I think for so many years, it was kind of the same cast of characters who are still around, and many of them are actually earned spots in our top 20 chef awards of the year. But there are also these really interesting new faces that are coming up that are really wowing not only us in LA, but nationally. And so it felt like the right time to really call attention to some of these new faces as well as some older ones.
Especially right now, it seems like so many restaurants are such a very particular point of view that could only happen if it were driven by the chef.
Yeah, the chef-driven restaurant is, you know, really kind of an invention of the last 20 years or so, I think, and it keeps getting more and more hyper-focused. You know, there was a while where you would go out to a restaurant and you knew the restaurant name, maybe you knew the maitre d' or the host, but you didn't always know who was back there cooking. My, how that has changed.
Totally.
So now, really, it's all about the chef. And the restaurants are getting smaller. The dishes are getting smaller. The point of view is getting really narrow and very particular. So it's gotten to the point where you can follow a chef like Joseph Centeno, for instance, who was at Lot 1 and then Lazy Ox and now Bacar Makat. I'm still sort of falling in love with Baco, yet he's already talking about his next project, which is really interesting to me in particular. It's right around the corner from Baco on 4th Street, and the menu concept might surprise you.
Actually, it's not going to surprise me because I was shocked when I walked out of Bacar Makat the last time I was there, walked around the corner and saw the paper on the window coming.
Bar Ama.
And I was just like, oh my God, he's going to do some kind of taco place. But it's not a regular taqueria like we're used to.
It's not. And I'll say, full disclosure, my husband is from Texas. So he taught me the value of what Tex-Mex cuisine is, which is an entirely different cuisine. It's not necessarily just bad Mexican food like we've thought of in the past.
So let's hear a little bit from Joseph.
You're right about it being considered like just a lot of cheese and sour cream and fake guacamole. But for me, this new restaurant that I'm going to do is called Bar Ma. It's paying homage to my great-great-grandmother and my grandmothers and the food that I grew up with. A lot of different cultures moved to Mexico during different war periods, and my family is Mexican, Spanish, German, French, Irish, Polish, and so I have this whole mix of bloodlines where they went to Mexico, but then they came to Texas in the early 1900s. So there's a lot of, like, just simple dishes like a fideo with tomato and water and salt. Not even the use of garlic that I remember growing up with that my great-grandmother, Ama, would have cooking on the stove with refried beans and making fresh corn tortillas, and it was like the most simplistic meal, but she had to be. She had 14 kids. And they say that's where I get my palate in the family from. It's oftentimes you find that the memories of food are a lot better than the reality. I made a trip back to San Antonio a month and a half ago and ate at over 25 different restaurants and realized that that was indeed the case. So Barama is going to be my take on the best of those memories. We'll have the puffy tacos. There's going to be the cabrito, which is the baby kid goat, which is a very northern Mexican delicacy. We're going to have my great-grandmother's enchiladas, which is a dry enchilada, not the soppy wet one that you see at most restaurants. We're going to have sopapillas, which are like giant dough pillows with cinnamon and honey, and fajitas. How can I forget the fajitas?
Of course, the sizzling platter that they have to carry through like they do at these restaurants. Okay, so I was lucky enough to have one of the first puffy tacos that was ever served last night, which was incredible. But explain for those who don't know, what is a puffy taco?
Basically, it's fresh corn masa, like you would make a fresh corn tortilla on the plancha, but you deep fry it and it souffles. And then with a spatula, you go and kind of give it the crease in the center so the shape of a taco forms. And you fry it so that it's crispy, but it's still chewy. And it has to be done to order. You can't do them in advance, otherwise they get soggy and they lose their crispness.
Well, and the key is that you don't, it's not like those sort of tortilla bowls that you see at like fast food places or something. It doesn't get quite that crispy. It's like in between. It's really got a chew to it. So you can still kind of squish it. You get that tear sensation with your teeth, but it's still a little bit greasier and more indulgent than, say, a regular tortilla. So let's go see how to make one. Okay, so we're in your kitchen. Show me how to make the puffy taco.
Okay, so basically we have our fresh corn masa. We just drop it in the fryer. We're gonna wait for it to rise, and then we want it to souffle.
So you can see it kind of just bubbling up. It just starts to get really bubbly in there.
And you wanna crease it in the center so that it'll fry like in the shape of a taco shell. And we're just gonna hold it down. That's why these need to be done to order, because since they're not like super crispy, it's a mix of crispy and chewy. They will lose their crispness relatively fast. We're looking for the right color, and we'll drain it, and then y'all will get to eat a puffy taco.
Yeah, so what are we gonna put in this puffy taco?
Right now we're gonna do, it's a beef and pork belly mix with cilantro and onions, some cascabel chili, and like a dry chili salsa. It'll have arbol, cascabel, some sunflower seeds and sesame, and a little bit of tomato and onion.
So you're putting this awesome beef and pork mix in there, but traditionally, what's going in these? If I was in San Antonio, what am I going to get in my puffy taco?
You get like shredded chicken or like a picadillo, which is ground beef with potato and peppers and tomato and onion. But I'll be doing a lot of my versions of different meat combinations with lengua, beef shank, and lamb shank, chicken escabeche.
And last night when I had mine, it was a lot of really great like acid and texture in there. You know, aside from, you know, the meat and then the frying of this, you're making sure to put a lot of really great fresh ingredients and fresh flavors in there too to balance it out.
Well, that's where it's going to be doing my take on it, because it will be like the style of cooking that I do. And I do use a lot of acid and try to find a lot of balance. You'll find it a lot of the tacos in San Antonio. Sometimes the only acid is the hot sauce and maybe like a lemon on the side.
Okay, so this looks amazing. It's spilling over with, you can see meat and some avocado, some really great cabbage, and then some sort of spicy greatness on the top that I'm not even sure about. It's really hot, but still kind of floppy, not too crispy. And I'm gonna go in for what looks like a delicious bite. Oh man. That's amazing. The textures, the temperatures, there's cool, there's hot, there's crunchy, there's salty. It's really, really great. Joseph, these are amazing. It's incredible. All I'm missing is the tequila. Thank you so much again. It's a little early, but thank you so much, Joseph.
Thank you.
That was Joseph Centeno talking about his forthcoming restaurant, Bar Ama. We can all look forward to puffy tacos coming to downtown in December this year.
I've never had a puffy taco. I am so excited, although I fear that the wait for a puffy taco will be huge once he opens.
Your waistline may never be the same, but you won't care. I'll put it that way.
What's so interesting to me right now is we're such a city of eaters that worship ethnic food. And it's like this golden moment where so many chefs are now taking the flavor palette that they love from somewhere in the world, whether it's part of their own heritage or from travel, and they're fusing it with the incredible ingredients that we have from the farmers markets. And they're coming up with something completely different. For example, I know that Micah Wexler is doing some really interesting things with Middle Eastern food at Meze.
I agree. We decided also to honor Micah Wexler of Meze in the issue. And part of that is because of what he's kind of dubbed Bubby cuisine. He's taking his Jewish heritage, combining it with sort of Judaism's heritage, which is the Middle East, and then fusing that with California, really fresh ingredients, and putting out a really unique style of cuisine that I think is all his and also particularly Los Angeles.
That Bubby would have a hard time recognizing.
Bubby would never have dreamed to see her plates created that well.
Yeah, the last time he was in the studio with me, we started talking about the spice cabinet, because that's one thing that really fascinates me is how all over the world there just seems to be these representative, emblematic, either spice blends or pantry ingredients that you put together, and it just creates that very particular snapshot of the food of that area. So I asked him to start us off with a definition of za'atar.
Za'atar itself is an actual herb, which is kind of difficult to procure in this country. It's something that grows wild in the Middle East. You see it especially a lot in Israel. It'll just kind of be growing all over the hillsides. And the best way to really describe it, it's, you know, often referred to as wild thyme, sort of a cross between thyme and oregano. And then the blend of za'atar is that wild thyme, which has been dried, mixed with some sesame seed, sumac, and sometimes salt if you want to.
And I understand that the blending of za'atar is a very proprietary thing. Like in families, they hold those proportions very close.
It is. It's definitely one of those things. And I've traveled to Israel several times, and it was always interesting to kind of compare the Israeli za'atar versus the Palestinian za'atar. They're really very different. It is a different blend and ratios and all that kind of stuff. And, you know, it's something that was important to us also when we opened the restaurant that we wanted to have our own blend of za'atar. So it's something we worked on for a while to come up with our own proprietary blend. You know, people ask me sometimes, oh, well, what do you use it on? And the thing is really, what do you not use it on? I mean, it's great on breads. It's great on chicken. It's great on fish, vegetables. It really can be a great all-purpose kind of seasoning that, you know, because the sumac, it has that lemoniness to it, but obviously it also has that herbaceous notes from the za'atar itself. It can be used on so many things. It's really great.
So let's talk about sumac.
Yeah.
What is it?
It's actually a berry. And sumac's one of my favorite spices, especially because I just really like the story of it. So acid and lemon is a huge, huge part of Middle Eastern food. And obviously, lemons have a season, although they don't seem to these days. But at one time in history, they did have a season. And when lemons were out of season, Middle Eastern cooks were still looking for that sharp, lemony, acidic flavor. And sumac, it has that. It literally tastes like lemons. And it's a dried berry that's ground up. So when the lemons were out of season, they used sumac.
And I always think that it goes even farther back than that. Like since citrus came from China,
Yeah. It
must have taken a while for citrus to make its way from China to the Middle East. And they probably had those berries.
Yeah, I mean, berries, you know, they're indigenous. They're wild. I mean, you can even find them occasionally growing in some of the chaparral and stuff around California. You're probably right. They probably had that even before citrus.
How do you like to use it?
A few different ways. You know, sometimes we'll make infusions with sumac, you know, to make like a sumac oil, or even if, you know, if we're using it in like a gelée or something like that, it's great in vinaigrettes too. Like for example, you know, we have the fattoush salad on our menu, which is a classic Lebanese salad. And the dressing, I mean, I think sometimes people think that it's something super exotic. It's like the easiest dressing ever to make. You know, olive oil, sumac, lemon juice, a little bit of pomegranate molasses, and you're done. You got a great salad right there.
So good. There's another spice that I really love, and when I first discovered it, I went crazy, and that's Aleppo pepper.
Yeah. Aleppo pepper is great. I mean, another one of my favorite ones in the arsenal. It's from Aleppo in Syria, and I think the best thing to compare it to, if people are familiar with espalette pepper, which can be a really expensive ground Basque pepper, Aleppo is very, very similar and about a tenth the price.
And it comes packed in huge bags instead of tiny, tiny
exactly.
little.
Exactly. Yeah, you can get a whole lot of it, you know, and it's got this kind of. It's not very spicy at all, but it definitely does have a little bit of spice. It's got a nice smokiness to it. It's great. It's a really exotic spice.
One of my favorite elements from the Middle East spice cabinet is this thing called duka.
Yeah.
You can go crazy with that stuff.
Yeah, you really can. It's like popcorn. You know, it's super addictive. You can literally eat handfuls of it. You know, duka's kind of an interesting story. I mean, one of the things that I always say about these spice blends in the Middle East is that every country has their go-to blend. So, you know, za'atar, which we talked about, is very Israeli-Palestinian thing. You have baharat from Lebanon, and duka is kind of the classic Egyptian spice blend. Again, there's like a lot of variations on it. The one that we make has hazelnuts, coriander, black pepper, sesame seed, dried mint, and some flake sea salt, some Maldon salt. And, you know, again, you can use it just sprinkled on top of things. It's really great when you just mix it with a little bit of olive oil. If you have some fresh pita or flatbread and just dip it in. It's got great texture, which is really nice. It's really crunchy, and you get that nuttiness from the hazelnuts. It's just a great spice.
Do you pound it, or do you put it through a spice grinder?
I mean, we make so much of it that we do it. We put it in a Robocoup, a food processor. But yeah, I mean, at home, I think a mortar and pestle is definitely the way to go.
I actually use it in pie crust.
Yeah, that sounds great, actually.
So good. And on rice with curries.
Yeah. Absolutely.
It's one of those things that when you get into it, you said it's like popcorn. It's also unbelievable on popcorn.
Yeah, for sure. I've definitely done that one. And it's cool. You know, like you can, if you start with the base of duka, you know, it does work for sweet and savory, and you can go down a lot of avenues with it. You know, we do one where we'll make like a hard caramelized sugar, and we'll grind that up with the duka. We make a pistachio version of it, and it's really incredible.
Sounds like it'd be good on ice cream, too.
Yeah, it would be.
Thank you so much.
Absolutely. Thank you.
What a fun conversation. That was Michael Wexler. He's the chef partner at Meze in West Hollywood. You can check out the Good Food blog for some outtakes of our conversation that we couldn't fit on air and a recipe for Micah's fattoush salad with sumac vinaigrette.
Next, we are going to visit with a very interesting chef who doesn't have a restaurant or a pop-up or a truck, yet he still managed to become one of the most talked about chefs in town.
This story is one which truly fascinates me. So stay tuned. Leslie and I will be back with more of our chef show after this short break.
This is Jillian Ferguson, producer of Good Food. Keep up with us all week long on our blog. You'll find recipes, photos, cooking tips, and videos. Go to kcrw.com/goodfood.
Welcome back to Good Food. I'm Evan Kleiman, and here with me today is Leslie Barger-Suter, dine editor for Los Angeles Magazine.
Hello.
Los Angeles Magazine Chef's issue is on stands right now, and Leslie's here with me today to discuss the men and women who make the food we love. So, Leslie, one of the chefs that you selected in the issue is Craig Thornton, who a lot of people have probably never heard of, yet he's doing one of the most interesting things happening in town.
He is quite possibly the buzziest chef that nobody's heard of in Los Angeles and possibly nationwide. Craig Thornton is doing a sort of food-based art project called Wolf's Mouth, which is sort of an underground supper club that he runs out of his loft. And it's really, really creative. He sort of likes to control everything from the actual people who eat there to exactly what the plating is like. You're sitting, you know, a few feet away from him when you're eating at this place. And the food is hyper-modern. He's very conceptual, quasi-manic in this incredible creative artist kind of way. And it's really a dinner experience beyond anything we've had before. I'll let him describe it.
Essentially, it's just my weird, twisted idea of how I want to express myself through food, through cooking, through whatever it is. And right now, I guess, you know, for people eating, people go to the website, they sign up, you get on the mailing list, we send out dates, and then people basically put in for those dates. We go through there, we pick out who's going to be eating, and then people show up. I mean, it's incredibly simple, but to keep it all kind of working is a really complex little machine.
So it's intriguing, and yet I still have a ton of questions.
Absolutely, as you should.
You've been to one of these dinners before, yes?
Yes.
Do you have to send in an application to get a space?
Oh, yes. You go onto his website and you type in not only your contact info and all of that, but there's sort of this blank field where you're going to enter in something that's going to make you really sound intriguing and stand out.
So it's like a college essay?
Absolutely. Yeah, but hopefully, you know, it can be a haiku if you want. And then they have a guy named Dim Sum Pup. His name's Julian, who goes through and picks out people. And there's only 18 people that get to eat at each dinner. And they particularly pick people that seem like they're from different backgrounds, different parts of the city, different attitudes, because not only is the food part of this Wolves Mouth art project, but the actual dining table and the people who are there are kind of creating this performance art themselves.
Does he want to end up in a full-blown restaurant of his own?
This is what he's described sort of as a phase one. I don't think it's sustainable. Operating it out of his house and just with the equipment and the demands, he wants to really reach out to more people. So he's actively seeking out a more conventional restaurant space, but that he swears up and down is going to be anything but a conventional restaurant. He really prizes this unique environment that he's managed to create around this Wolves Mouth concept. I was at Craig's apartment actually recently where I asked him about this approach.
For me personally, I felt like by being in kitchens, it's like you learn a lot about cooking, but I think that you learn more a lot about like a philosophy, you know, or kind of like your, I guess, moral code of cooking, you know, or an organization and how things actually run. I felt like by me doing this, I would be able to push myself further, create dishes. I mean, half the dishes that I create now, I would have never even thought of had I been in you know, these restaurant kitchens. It's not to say that restaurant kitchens are bad or anything like that. It's for me personally, I wanted to develop my own style, my own taste. And after doing it, I don't think it's for everybody. That's for sure. It takes a lot more sacrifice than what it looks like from the outside. I think a lot of people just think like, oh, like you just throw dinners together. But it's full-time, just never-ending. But things break, just like restaurants. People leave, just like restaurants. It's all very similar. The biggest part of it is being able to have the freedom to do the kind of food that I want to do and, I guess, build up my own arsenal of how I do things.
You can see photos of some of Craig's amazing food on the Good Food blog. It is truly a work of art. I recommend you go eat there if, of course, you can manage to get a spot.
You know, I have to tell you that when I heard that we were doing a chef show, I knew we had to talk to Michael Ruhlman. He's not a chef anymore, but there's really no one out there who really understands what it takes to become a chef, and also the personality. What about a person uniquely gives them elements that they can thrive being a chef? But he's written these two books, The Making of a Chef and The Soul of Chef, over 10 years ago. And I've been thinking so much about how in the years that have passed since his books came out, this incredible mania of food has developed, and all of social media and all of the TV. So I asked Michael how this near obsessive interest in food has changed the making of a chef.
Well, because of this obsessive interest in food, we've created almost accidentally a almost utopic food society. There's never been a better time to be a cook, because of all the ingredients that are now available, and fresh farmed ingredients and hand-raised pigs and amazing cooking tools and great ingredients. And there's never been a better time to be an eater because of this as well. Because there is such interest in food, there's great opportunities for chefs, for entrepreneurs, for home cooks, for anyone who wants to get into the business. Now, it's not easy, and you don't make a lot of money. You only do it if you love it. I mean, I certainly wouldn't want my son or daughter to become a chef. And I would urge them not to be. And if they became one anyway, then I knew they were doing it for the right reason. You got to do it because you love it. It's just, as you know, Evan, it's really hard work for low pay. There are very few Kellers and von Gerichtens and Ballous out there who can start empires. And those guys work their asses off for decades before they see any return of any value on their investment.
Now, a lot of people, when they think about being a chef, they have one image, and that is a chef in a restaurant. What other opportunities are there for people who have trained as a chef to earn a living?
The chef that you described that most people think of as being a chef is probably the minority of chef out there. There's research, there's writing, there's personal chefs, there's corporate chefs. There are all kinds of chef jobs out there that are available. But again, you know, it's a lot of work for little money. You don't get paid a lot unless you're the owner of a business. So when you work in food service, you're not going to make a ton of money, certainly not at first. There's also food development. I mean, you know, the inventors of Terra Chips were in the same class as Rocco DiSpirito at the CIA.
Let's talk a little bit about core competencies, because I've known, for example, people who have gone to culinary school, spent all the money, did really well in school, but then just didn't have the speedy chops to actually make it in a high-pressured food service environment. What are some core competencies or personality traits that you think are suited to a profession in food?
Well, it helps to have apparently extreme attention deficit disorder in order to be a successful cook. I can't tell you how many people I know who just fit really well in the kitchen because they are just, you know, they just got all this energy and have a hard time focusing on it, on anything else. I hated being a line cook when I was a line cook. I was always petrified of not being ready for service and then just getting your ass handed to you when you weren't prepared. And I just don't have the temperament for service. Some people really like that intense adrenaline rush that you get from service and being prepared. And the chefs who are most successful, I mean, look at Thomas Keller. One of his traits I noticed early on, which he knew very well too, was he loved to do the same thing over and over and over. He loved to peel asparagus. He could peel asparagus all day. He loved to turn artichokes. It's one of the most onerous kitchen jobs there is, turning artichokes. He can turn them with his feet. He just loves them. So this capacity to do monotonous labor and to try and perfect it, get better and better at it each time, was one of the reasons why he was a very successful restaurant chef. The chefs who are really talented restaurant chefs really just love working with their hands, love doing the same thing over and over again, and love that intense monotony for 8 hours followed by 6 hours of high pressure anxiety. You know, that's basically what your life is when you're a line cook at a good restaurant. You'd never wish this on anybody that you cared about. And yet there it is. There they are. But there's the good thing is that there are some people for whom the kitchen life is the only life where they feel comfortable. So I'm glad that we do have this life for them. But don't go into it thinking that it's some glorious world. I mean, even in fairly accurate TV portrayals, like in Tremé, I know Tony Bourdain helped write some of the second season of that. But even that is glorified. TV can't help but somehow glorify and distort actual kitchen life.
Well, thank you very much for your thoughts on this profession that seems to just be fascinating people.
It does, and there's a reason for it. It's a fascinating profession. And this must be said, and you know it too, the best people to hang out with are other cooks. There's no more generous, no more fun, no more alive individual that I've ever met, or groups of individuals, type of individuals, than the professional cook. So if you want to have a good time, make friends with some professional cooks.
That was the one and only Michael Ruhlman. Just yesterday, he released a Kindle single about his unlikely journey from writer to cook and then back to writer again.
I absolutely adore Michael Ruhlman. The Soul of a Chef was one of my absolute favorite all-time chef-oriented books. It's just incredible. I will say reading his books made me sure that I did not want to be a chef. I'll put it that way. But he really, really captures the essence. I think he's great.
So I think you might be excited about our next guest. She's not local, but to me, she epitomizes the chef's chef. So we absolutely had to include her in this week's show.
April Bloomfield.
Yeah, she's the chef behind a growing number of restaurants in New York, including the Spotted Pig, the Breslin, and the John Dory Oyster Bar. She's joining us here today to talk about what she does best.
The gastropub, which is the trend that will not die. It is everywhere in Los Angeles, and it's wonderful. We actually, in the September issue, talked to Sang Yoon, who sort of locally was part of bringing the gastropub here. You know, Jonathan talked about the Parish earlier, which is sort of a new evolution. So these are all elements of this gastropub movement that's happening here in L.A.
And for better or for worse, we owe that whole movement to April Bloomfield. So I asked her to set the record straight and tell us exactly what a gastropub is.
Okay, so a gastropub classically is, an old pub that's kind of redone. It's kind of had a breath of fresh air put into it. Great cask beer, great wine, awesome kind of top shelf liquor with a great chef in a kitchen.
In order to appear really authentic and have us relate to them in a certain way, do they need to have really been a pub originally, or can you start one fresh from the ground up?
Classically in England, they were always kind of built from old pubs, like existing pubs that were, kind of being sold off because, they were pretty expensive to run. So they were a little run down. So they just kind of kept it quite raw, just put a lick of paint in there and put a great chef in there. But, now the ones that have kind of come into New York, they're not in necessarily like an old tavern. So, yeah, it doesn't need to be that way.
But the environments are so comfortable. They sort of have this sense that they have had a past life.
Yeah, I think that's the fun thing about a gastropub in England is the fact that it's got this old kind of energy and it's got some history. It's a local pretty much where you could probably dine in there like 5 times a week rather than a fine dining restaurant where it's a little bit more stiff and you could probably only do that maybe once a month.
In your cookbook, A Girl and Her Pig, which came out last year, you describe your cooking as anal rustic,
yeah.
which I love. How do you marry those two styles in the kitchen?
Well, I love comfort food, and comfort food's quite rustic in a way. It's not too many ingredients on a plate. I try and find a balance with not deconstructing too much, but just kind of allowing the food to speak for itself. You have to be quite restrained, I suppose, in a way, and know you kind of your limits a little bit. But I just try and use natural textures instead of chopping something away that maybe somebody else would do.
I think a really good description of sort of this marriage for you is the way that you chop carrots, you describe in the book. Could you talk about that a little bit?
I learned this kind of technique of chopping vegetables from Rose Gray from the River Cafe. And I remember my first day, kind of cooking, and I was like, wow, no square vegetables. This is like revolutionary, but there's kind of a method behind that. And a lot had to do with the way it kind of broke down. If you were cooking carrots in a soup, you kind of chop it in kind of like an oblique shape, and then so you get these sharp angles and then these kind of like right angles, and the sharper angles would kind of like break down and make the soup thick and be much more rustic instead of something that was kind of al dente and kind of had kept that kind of oblique shape.
So now you have 3 restaurants in New York. You have the Spotted Pig, and at the Ace Hotel you have the Breslin and John Dory.
Right.
If we decided that we wanted to have all of our meals by eating at each restaurant throughout the day, I would love it if you could give us a suggestion for each meal. So, for example, let's start at the Breslin for breakfast.
Oh, my goodness. Breakfast is like my favorite time just because I love to cook eggs, and I love when you crack an egg in a pan, it goes all like, it makes this noise, it goes pop, 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 and it gets all crispy around the edge, and you just sprinkle it with salt. Anyway, I love breakfast. So we do this amazing English breakfast, and we make all our own bacon and sausages. We make our own blood sausage, and we just do it with some sautéed mushrooms, a little bit of roasted tomato, and a fried egg. But I don't know, it's perfect, you know, because you get a little this kind of gamey, like blood sausage, and then you get this really kind of classic English pork sausage that's made purely of pork fat and the tiniest amount of breadcrumb and a little nutmeg just to add to that kind of Englishness.
Wow. Okay. Then after we have this breakfast, we're going to have to walk all over Manhattan. And then we will meet you once again at the Spotted Pig for lunch.
Ooh, yeah. Okay. We do an amazing burger at the Spotted Pig. It's basically a beef hamburger that comes on a brioche bun with a little bit of salty roquefort cheese that come with like this huge pile of steamy, crisp shoestring fries that's like kind of, you know, got these flecks of rosemary and, you know, sweet kind of caramelized garlic running through them. And it's really great because you can just pile those on top of the burger with the roquefort and then kind of squish the bun down. And then, you know, you get this just like elegant burger, you know, kind of rummaging around in your mouth. It's amazing.
So we are having lunch, so maybe we could start to consume some alcohol. And we are, after all, at the best gastropub in New York. So what should we drink while we're having that burger?
Oh, that's a good one. We have a couple of cask ales that's made locally for us. We have a Brooklyn style bitter that's called the Spotted Pig bitter, which is served at kind of that cask temperature, so it's not too icy cold. Just having a pint of that with the burger and the shoestring fries, you know, I could eat that right now.
Okay, so now I think we actually have to work out. And we might take a run through Central Park and then go home.
Oh, a run?
Yeah, a run.
Maybe a nap.
Yeah, a nap and then a run. A nap and then a run to get ready for dinner. And then, of course, we're going to have to change.
Right.
And now maybe some fish, because we've eaten pretty heavy today. So we're going to end up at John Dory for dinner.
Yeah, John Dory dinner, glass of cava, maybe a dozen oysters for happy hour. Oh, my goodness. You know, some crudo, some raw fish that we do very simply in different preparations. One I love right now is a hiramasa with some ginger puree, a little bit of crispy hiramasa skin, and some myoga ginger, which is a cross between like a light ginger and a shallot. It's the flower of the ginger plant.
Wow, fascinating. Thank you so much, April.
Awesome. Thank you for having me. I've had a great time. Thanks.
That was Chef April Bloomfield. She'll be cooking right here in L.A. next Saturday, the 29th, at L.A. Loves Alex's Lemonade. You can find out where to buy tickets for the event on the Good Food blog. Coming up, L.A. Beer Week is happening right now. Hear about two of our local beer heroes in 30 seconds. You're listening to Good Food.
Good Food is produced by KCRW, a listener-supported public radio station. Search for KCRW in the podcast section of iTunes to find other programs like Bookworm, The Treatment, The Business, Unfictional, and DNA. And thanks for listening.
You're listening to Good Food on KCRW and KCRW.com. Today, I have been truly enjoying the company of Leslie Barger Suter, dine editor for Los Angeles Magazine. The theme of our show today has been chefs.
But we are now going to veer away from chefs and talk about something that chefs enjoy just as much as food, beer.
Yeah, it's Beer Week.
LA Beer Week is underway, and so we thought we'd highlight some of our hometown heroes of the huge local craft brew scene. KCRW producer Evan George has more for us.
It was late on a recent weekend afternoon, and I was fighting my way through the beer aisle of Whole Foods when I saw it. A corked bottle bearing the logo of my neighborhood brewery. I grabbed it triumphantly, cradling it all the way to the checkout. Has this happened to you recently? For such a simple pleasure, there's nothing easy about your favorite local beer finding its way onto the shelves of the grocery aisle. In fact, it's downright hard. But luckily, that's not stopping LA's new generation of small and mid-sized brewers eager to get their beer into your mouth. It requires one of two things, bottles or cans. A growing brewery has to outgrow kegs and bars and figure out how to get their beer into your fridge as well. And that means learning how to run a manufacturing line, design labels, and reach distribution deals. Jeremy Raub is co-founder of Eagle Rock Brewery. I asked him to walk me through how the small staff is managing growing pains of bottling, from a cramped one-story brewery and taproom in Glassell Park.
So we just started bottling in April, and so right now we're doing probably about 30% of our production is bottled. That may change over time. We'll sort of have to wait and see how it develops and what the market sort of demands, what people want more of. The four sort of flagship beers that we do are the only four that we're regularly bottling and having available year-round.
On the morning I visited, Jeremy and his coworkers, which include his wife, Ting, and his father, Steve, were preparing to fill 64-ounce shiny brown glass bottles, about 1,500 of them, in 1 hour. Their mobile bottling machine looks almost like a gadget you would find in a hospital room. It's 5 feet long with a waterproof touchscreen. It's covered in Post-it notes, reminding them what to do and what not to do.
This is a great little unit because it only costs us, I should say only costs us, it's pretty expensive, but it only costs about $55,000. But it's a pretty small entry fee to getting into a bottling line because most commercial bottling lines run around $1 million to get started.
Once loaded, the bottles inch up this ramp towards a platform where they're sanitized and then pumped with beer. On the other end, a large magnetic wheel grabs the bottle caps from a hopper and feeds a capping piston that rams the tops onto the filled beer bottles.
There's usually a broken bottle or two at some point in the process. Sometimes the sensors on the machine won't sense that a bottle is actually in line ready to be filled, or that there's a bottle there and there really isn't. And so sometimes the filling heads will slam down as if they're going to go into the bottle, but actually break the bottle apart.
When Jeremy and his dad started homebrewing years ago, they never imagined they'd be bottling thousands of gallons of it for customers from San Diego to Santa Barbara.
I guess, you know, it was one of those crazy dream things that at some point I did think, wouldn't it be cool if I could do this? But yeah, it is a reality, and it's funny because about 6 weeks or so after we had done our first bottling, we were so busy we hadn't been able to actually see our bottles on store shelves. So like friends and customers were sending us pictures of our beers on store shelves, and we were getting all excited. Yeah, I think it was 6 weeks after we started bottling that my wife and I went into a Whole Foods and actually bought one of our beers off the shelves.
If you hop on your bike and ride 3 miles down San Fernando Road along the train tracks, there's another new brewery with even larger ambitions. Golden Road Brewing occupies 3 brightly painted warehouses. The yellow one is a huge pub filled on weekends with bicyclists and families. But it's the blue building at the end of the row where the real business is going on day in and day out. That's the brewery itself, which holds a dozen or more massive shiny metal tanks, pumping out 8,000 barrels of beer a year. Amid all the tanks is Canland. It says so on a ceiling banner in big letters. It's here that the brewery packs their signature 16-ounce tall boys of Hefeweizen and IPA. The hero of Canland is a 50-foot-long machine that loads hundreds of these cans into a single-file line. Picture an elaborate toy train set, but with the threat of beer spraying everywhere. The cans start out as just the bottom and the sides with no top. They spin forward towards a fill station where they are sprayed and rinsed and then injected with CO2. Then they're filled with precisely 15.9 ounces of beer and stamped with a lid that seals perfectly. Golden Road fills about 24 of these cans per minute. Now that might sound like a lot, but compared to the big boys in brewing, like Busch or Miller, it's nothing. Golden Road's head brewer, John Carpenter, should know. He used to work at Anheuser-Busch.
It's kind of nice because this is like Mr. Rogers' neighborhood to me. This is like really fun, like I get to watch it. The new high-speed lines do, I think, about 2,500 cans a minute. So we're doing 24 cans a minute. They're doing 2,500 cans a minute. So it's only about 100 times faster.
Now, if Jeremy Raub wants you to find his bottles in any gourmet grocery aisle, Golden Road Brewing president Meg Gill has a different idea. She wants you to be able to find a 6-pack of their IPA in any corner drugstore or CVS.
Wherever you're shopping, you need to find the local brewer, and that's our long-term goal for this. And the best way to deliver that was through cans.
And why cans, you ask? Aren't they just the vehicle of choice for frat dudes who pound Keystone? Well, after college, Meg did a business internship, not on Wall Street, but near Boulder, Colorado, at a brewery called Oscar Blues. It's one of the first microbreweries to hit the big time with fancy canned beer. And according to Meg, cans make for fresher beer.
The can protects beer from the major enemies of beer, light and oxygen. So light can't penetrate through aluminum the way that it penetrates through glass.
So far, Golden Road's gift to the Los Angeles drinking scene is Point the Way IPA. It aims for the big flavor of a West Coast IPA without the higher alcohol content. The idea is a craft beer made for a car culture. Even the outside of their cans reflect the local drinker. They're using a new high-resolution technology that allows them to print actual photos right onto the aluminum. Photos taken around Northeast LA.
We're creating a mood about craft beer in LA. The photographers that we hire to do the shoots that we then, you know, choose the photos for are all local. Our kind of rule is it needs to be in a 5-mile radius where all the photographs are shot.
The result is beer cans decked out in palm trees and downtown skyline. So there's no mistaking where these beers were born. Is San Diego still the capital of beer country? Yes. Does the Bay Area have us beat on brewing? Sure. But with a half dozen new breweries open in just a couple years, Los Angeles is finally starting to hold its own. If you eat local, you can extend that to your beer runs thanks to LA Beer Week, which is happening right now. Grab a bottle or a can. For Good Food, I'm Evan George. Cheers.
That was KCRW producer Evan George. He was talking about Eagle Rock Brewery and Golden Road Brewing, which celebrates its first anniversary today, in fact. Find out more about LA Beer Week on the Good Food blog.
If you missed any part of today's show, you can listen anytime you want at kcrw.com or via iTunes. You can also find Good Food on Demand on KCRW's apps for the iPod, Android, and BlackBerry. For more coverage on LA's top chefs, head to newsstands where you can find the Los Angeles Magazine's Chef's Issue.
Good Food is produced by Jillian Ferguson. Laurel Garcia is our segment producer, and our executive producer is Harriet Ells. Thanks to Ronnie Mickelson, Gary Messiha, Sarah Rogazin, and a special thanks to Leslie Barker-Suter for joining me today. That was so much fun.
Thanks, Evan. I had a blast.
I'm Evan Kleiman, and I'll see you back here next week for another edition of Good Food.